Helen's Exile. The Mediterranean sun has something tragic about it, quite different from the tragedy of fogs. Certain evenings at the base of the seaside mountains, night falls over the flawless curve of a little bay, and there rises from the silent waters a sense of anguished fulfillment. In such spots one can understand that if the Greeks knew despair, they always did so through beauty and its stifling quality. In that gilded calamity, tragedy reaches its highest point. Our time, on the other hand, has fed its despair on ugliness and convulsions. This is why Europe would be vile if suffering could ever be so. We have exiled beauty. The Greeks took up arms for her. First difference, but one that has a history. Greek thought always took refuge behind the conception of limits. It never carried anything to extremes, neither the sacred nor reason, because it negated nothing, neither the sacred nor reason. It took everything into consideration, balancing shadow with light. Our Europe, on the other hand, often the pursuit of totality, is the child of disproportion. She negates beauty as she negates whatever she does not glorify. And through all her diverse ways, she glorifies but one thing, which is the future rule of reason. In her madness, she extends the eternal limits, and at that very moment, dark Erinyes fall upon her and tear her to pieces. Nemesis, the goddess of measure and not of revenge, keeps watch. All those who overstep the limit are pitilessly punished by her. The Greeks, who for centuries questioned themselves as to what is just, could understand nothing of our idea of justice. For them, equity implied a limit, whereas our whole continent is convulsed in its search for a justice that must be total. At the dawn of Greek thought, Heraclitus was already imagining that justice sets limits for the physical universe itself. The sun will not overstep his measures. If he does, the Erinyes, the handmaids of justice, will find him out. We who have cast the universe and spirit out of our sphere laugh at that threat. In a drunken sky, we light up the suns we want. But nonetheless, the boundaries exist, and we know it. In our wildest aberrations, we dream of an equilibrium we have left behind, which we naively expect to find at the end of our errors. Childish presumption, which justifies the fact that child nations, inheriting our follies, are now directing our history. A fragment attributed to the same Heraclitus simply states, "Presumption, regression of progress." And many centuries after the man of Ephesus, Socrates, facing the threat of being condemned to death, acknowledged only this one superiority in himself. What he did not know, he did not claim to know. The most exemplary life and thought of those centuries close on a profound confession of ignorance. Forgetting that, we have forgotten our virility. We have preferred the power that apes greatness. First Alexander, and then the Roman conquerors, whom the authors of our schoolbooks, through some incomparable vulgarity, teach us to admire. We too have conquered, moved boundaries, mastered heaven and earth. Our reason has driven all away. Alone, at last, we end up by ruling over a desert. What imagination could we have left for that higher equilibrium in which nature balanced history, beauty, virtue, and which applied the music of numbers even to blood tragedy? We turn our backs on nature. We are ashamed of beauty. Our wretched tragedies have a smell of the office clinging to them, and the blood that trickles from them is the color of printer's ink. This is why it is improper to proclaim today that we are the sons of Greece, or else we are the renegade sons. Placing history on the throne of God, we are progressing toward theocracy like those whom the Greeks called barbarians and whom they fought to death in the waters of Salamis. In order to realize how we differ, one must turn to him among our philosophers who is the true rival of Plato. Only the modern city, Hegel dares write, offers the mind a field in which it can become aware of itself. We are thus living in the period of big cities. Deliberately, the world has been amputated of all that constitutes its permanence: nature, the sea, hilltops, evening meditation. Consciousness is to be found only in the streets, because history is to be found only in the streets. This is the edict. And consequently, our most significant works show the same bias. Landscapes are not to be found in great European literature since Dostoevsky. History explains neither the natural universe that existed before it, nor the beauty that exists above it. Hence, it chose to be ignorant of them. Whereas Plato contained everything, nonsense, reason, and myth. Our philosophers contain nothing but nonsense or reason, because they have closed their eyes to the rest. The mole is meditating. It is Christianity that began substituting the tragedy of the soul for contemplation of the world. But at least Christianity referred to a spiritual nature and thereby preserved a certain fixity. With God dead, there remains only history and power. For some time, the entire effort of our philosophers has aimed solely at replacing the notion of human nature with that of situation, and replacing ancient harmony with the disorderly advance of chance or reason's pitiless progress. Whereas the Greeks gave to will the boundaries of reason, we have come to put the will's impulse in the very center of reason, which has, as a result, become deadly. For the Greeks, values preexisted all action, of which they definitely set the limits. Modern philosophy places its values at the end of action. They are not, but are becoming. And we shall know them fully only at the completion of history. With values, all limit disappears. And since conceptions differ as to what they will be, since all struggles, without the break of those same values, spread indefinitely, today's messianisms confront one another and their clamors mingle in the clash of empires. Disproportion is a conflagration, according to Heraclitus. The conflagration is spreading. Nietzsche is outdistanced. Europe no longer philosophizes by striking a hammer, but by shooting a cannon. Nature is still there, however. She contrasts her calm skies and her reasons with the madness of men. Until the atom, too, catches fire, and history ends in the triumph of reason and the agony of the species. But the Greeks never said that the limit could not be overstepped. They said it existed, and that whoever dared to exceed it was mercilessly struck down. Nothing in present history can contradict them. The historical spirit and the artist both want to remake the world. But the artist, through an obligation of his nature, knows his limits, which the historical spirit fails to recognize. This is why the latter's aim is tyranny, whereas the former's passion is freedom. All those who are struggling for freedom today are ultimately fighting for beauty. Of course, it is not a question of defending beauty for itself. Beauty cannot do without man, and we shall not give our era its nobility and serenity unless we follow it in its misfortune. Never again shall we be hermits. But it is no less true that man cannot do without beauty, and this is what our era pretends to want to disregard. It steels itself to attain the absolute and authority. It wants to transfigure the world before having exhausted it, to set it to rights before having understood it. Whatever it may say, our era is deserting this world. Ulysses can choose at Calypso's bidding between immortality and the land of his fathers. He chooses the land, and death with it. Such simple nobility is foreign to us today. Others will say that we lack humility, but all things considered, this word is ambiguous. Like Dostoevsky's fools who boast of everything, soar to heaven, and end up flaunting their shame in any public place, we merely lack man's pride, which is fidelity to his limits, lucid love of his condition. "I hate my time," Saint-Exupéry wrote shortly before his death, for reasons not far removed from those I have spoken of. But however upsetting that exclamation, coming from him who loved men for their admirable qualities, we shall not accept responsibility for it. Yet what a temptation at certain moments to turn one's back on this bleak, fleshless world. But this time is ours, and we cannot live hating ourselves. It has fallen so low only through the excess of its virtues as well as through the extent of its vices. We shall fight for the virtue that has a history. What virtue? The horses of Patroclus weep for their master killed in battle. All is lost. But Achilles resumes the fight, and victory is the outcome because friendship has just been assassinated. Friendship is a virtue. Admission of ignorance, rejection of fanaticism, the limits of the world and of man, the beloved face, and finally, beauty. This is where we shall be on the side of the Greeks. In a certain sense, the direction history will take is not the one we think. It lies in the struggle between creation and inquisition. Despite the price which artists will pay for their empty hands, we may hope for their victory. Once more the philosophy of darkness will break and fade away over the dazzling sea. O midday thought, The Trojan War is being fought far from the battlefields. Once more the dreadful walls of the modern city will fall to deliver up, soul serene as the ocean's calm, the beauty of Helen. 1948.